You have one degree of separation with Jeffers, having studied with Bill Everson.
Studying with Bill Everson, yeah, who is a real Jeffers aficionado.
Brother Antoninus, Mm-hmm. In the introduction to this book, there's a Cascadia connection, because you talk about Michael Daly, and you're, you know, you're illustrating the influence of D'Angelo on Pacific Coast culture, as it says in the subtitle. And there's a mention of the Del Mo'oma Journal, which took its name from one of the stories that he gathered. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that connection.
Sure. Del Mo'oma, properly, there's a deep glottal stop in there that's kind of an explosion in the larynx, but we Americans aren't really used to that. Del Mo'oma is a former Achimawi village, or Pitt River village, up near Alturas in California. And one of Angulo's best-known poems, songs, really a translation, comes from a woman doctor that he knew quite well. And the poem in his translation says, "Et del Mo'oma, in the spring, I dig wild turnips. At Del Mo'oma, in the spring, I harvest but rotten ones." And this was a shaman song, a very powerful one. Long after Angulo's death in the 1970s, a guy named Dale Pendel, who lived up in the Sierra foothills, founded a journal, or really took a journal he already had and retitled it Kuksu, and made what I think is really the first effort at a bioregional literary magazine. And he had a little kind of editorial note at the front saying that this was, the journal had been named Kuksu as to reference a Northern California in which the Kuksu cult or the Kuksu figure had been a primary focus of Native American mythological and religious life, and that anybody who lived in Kuksu country could immediately relate to the journal Kuksu, and it would also be a place for people who, as he put it, if they would not be comfortable residents in the California backcountry, would at least be comfortable guests here. And it was based on that journal that a couple of Cascadia people, Michael Daly and Jerry Gorslin and Finn Wilcox and eventually Red Pine, Bill Porter and Mike O'Connor and other people from around Port Townsend founded a journal and titled it Del Mo'oma. They wanted a bioregional journal, but they wanted to name it for a region outside of their own. They felt they were a little bit too sequestered just in Port Townsend. So they picked up that name of the Achimawi village, Pitt River Village. Pitt River, by the way, is the term that really encompasses about nine different tribes or tribelets that all that speak different languages. And that was the name that stuck. Angulo says no Indian up there would know the term Achimawi or Atsugewe. Pitt River was really what the Anglos and the Indians would have called. And Daryl Babe Wilson, who's part Atsugewe, told me how it happened. The Indians up there used to dig pits and cover them with brush to catch to capture deer. It was a hunting method. And the first early anthropologists up there fell into the pits and said, if there are pits, the river must be called Pitt River, and the people around here must be Pitt River people. And that was Daryl Babe Wilson's account.
Yeah, interesting how we get some names, how some of these names stick. You were mentioning last night different animals that we know as certain kinds of animals, but they're not, that I forget exactly the animals that you made reference to. Because of Lewis and Clark, was it?
Well, Lewis and Clark and other explorers. Yeah. It's just, that crazy thing of the American West that we have these very prevalent, the coyote was originally called the prairie wolf. It's not a wolf. The prairie dog is not a dog. Our pronghorn antelope is not an antelope, it's actually a species of goat. The horned toad is not a toad, it's a lizard, and so on and so forth. And once you get into the plant family, it gets even crazier.
Right, right.
choke cherry.
Right. How does a nice boy growing up in Paris with a nice Jesuit education decide to go to America and become a cattle rancher?
Because he hated the Jesuits and he hated Paris. he actually had a sort of romanticized notion that he would become a sheep herder. He needed to get away from his family. It was an eccentric, relatively well-to-do and very pious family.
Clock-loving family.
His father collected chronometers and spent all day long winding them and went through his wife's money until they were basically impoverished. Jaime described his father as, you know, really penny wise and pound foolish. This was a guy who would fill his pockets with little pieces of string he found on the street so that he never had to buy any string. But when the family went on vacation, he would hire a whole railroad car for them. And he thought it beneath his dignity to drink anything less than about a $100 bottle of champagne. And he would still cut the labels off of newspapers and use them for calling cards. So he was, Jaime just had to get out of there. It was a nightmare. And his father put him in a Jesuit convent, really, as for high school.
And not the kind of studies that he would have undertaken.
No. The Jesuits refused him any books on, you know, science or mathematics. And he was fascinated by physics and chemistry and math and all of that, and instead, you know, had to learn things that didn't appeal to him at all. So as soon as he turned 18 and was old enough to leave the family, he went over the wall like a convict escaping and went straight to America. He sailed to New York and landed in New York, and within 3 days had written a card back to his family. He was on a train headed for Colorado, where he was going to become, by then he realized it was a cowboy. There were sheep herders out there too, but cowboys and sheep herders didn't get along too well.
Cowboy, yeah. One of the tragic, perhaps the most tragic thing in his life was a car crash that not only took the life of his son, but also they were trapped for 12 hours and there was nothing he could do. He had to wait to be saved. Maybe you can talk about that and the ramifications of that, how that might have led to his addictions, the painkillers, and how that shaped the last couple decades of his life.
Jaime D'Angulo had, as I said, homesteaded in about 1914 on Partington Ridge. Partington Ridge is where eventually Henry Miller lived, the great jazz flautist Charles Lloyd, lots of artists and musicians and writers and people set up down there. But Jaime was really the first person down there on Partington Ridge. Several days' ride from the nearest stage stop, but in the 1920s and early 30s, the state of California decided they wanted to connect the Sur Country with a road. They put down a road there and eventually joined it to the national highway system. Jaime watched in sort of both fascination and growing distress as the road came down the coast, snaking down the coast, mostly built with convict labor, convicts from San Quentin. But other people signed up. John Steinbeck worked on it. There were, you know, a number of people. So there were mostly convicts and then other people who, you know, were paid very little. But once the road came down, it gave the Big Sur residents an opportunity to get things that they'd never really been able to bring in before, except on horseback. And it created a little reflex of building. And the Angulos really had a sort of outdoor camp with a little hunting cabin there, and they decided they could build a proper house. So they brought down cement. They had local trees they cut to make forms for cement. They could bring down glass. They could bring down wood stoves, you know, relatively easily by truck at that point. And once they built a house, it became a real bohemian center. Lots of people came and visited there. Most of California sort of bohemians, but people like Langston Hughes visited. There was a great poem folded into the logbook that Langston Hughes wrote for Jaime. And eventually, people like Robert Duncan and Jack Spicer would hitchhike down there and visit in the 1940s. But in 1933, shortly after the Angulos finished their house, they had a big party. And everybody decided to move the party up the highway a little bit. And they all rode horses down about a half a mile to where the car park was. And people piled into a couple of different automobiles. And Jaime and his son Alvar, who was 9 years old, climbed into a car with a woman. And it's a little disputed exactly what happened, but the car never made it to the other party they were going to. And it's not clear who was driving, probably not Jaime, but the car pitched off the road into Torres Canyon and fell 180 feet through the redwoods and lodged into the creek. Jaime's son Alvar was killed. Jaime broke his pelvis, ribs, a leg bone, and a shoulder. The stories say that his body pinned his dead son's body for the 12 hours it took for the driver of the car to extricate herself and climb up to the highway and flag somebody down and go for help. So by the time Jaime was pulled out of there, he was not only badly injured and in great physical pain, but he had lost his beloved son. And he was taken up to Monterey. When he was ready to leave the hospital, he went back down to the Big Sur house. His daughter sort of wonders why they didn't move back up to Berkeley, where things would have been a little more lively and there would have been better medical care. But it may really have been that this was the height of the Depression and they couldn't afford it, life in the Bay Area at that point. So he lived for a number of years without leaving the Big Sur Ranch. And most of the really pretty crazy, wild stories about his life, particularly at Big Sur, take place over the next 10 years. I tend to be very leery of those because I tracked in the book four different written accounts, each of the persons seeming to hallucinate onto Jaime Dangulo, kind of projected something or other that comes from themselves and not him. And many of the wild stories, I think, are probably moments of gregariousness in an otherwise very hermetically sealed 10 years, which I think of as really a medicine study in which he was not only recovering from the death of his son and his own injuries and his addiction to morphine and alcohol, but mourning the disappearance of languages and cultures all over California. And when he emerged sort of late in life, he finally left the ranch in the late 40s when he was diagnosed with prostate cancer. It was at that point that he did his really great work, particularly 100 broadcasts over KPFA radio, the original Pacific radio station in Berkeley, and put together his big manuscript, What is Language, and a great many of his poetry, translations of Federico Garcia Lorca. All of these things came really out of his last couple of years. So I take this about 15-year period down at Big Sur as a medicine study, and I don't think anybody needs to push too deeply into it, and that's certainly his daughter's feeling. You know, she says that people show up all the time who want to make Jaime Dangulo into a character of some sort and ask her for family journals and that sort of thing, and she finds it very intrusive on their privacy.
You've had some dealings with her.
Yeah, I got to know her quite well.
Yeah.
She's quite elderly.
Yeah. Born in 1928.
28. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.